not our emptiness in the four elements. In reading through the discourse number 140, Dhatu Bhogyanga Sutta, the exposition on the elements. This is the Buddha first taught the four elements meditation within the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. Then later on in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is one of the collections of his teachings, he goes into considerably more detail on the elements. And in that exposition on the elements, he adds another one. He adds the element of space. And so we're going to, so rather than this being the fourth and last one of these presentations, I'm going to add another one on 2 weeks from now. We're going to take up his teachings on space. Also, which are really quite fascinating. They have a lot of overlap with Tibetan teachings for any of those of you who may have done these. So, the upside of doing a series like this is that it allows for us to investigate a set of the Buddha's teachings together, you know, rather than just talking about a different unrelated topic every time we get together. The sometimes sort of shadow side of that is when intervening events prevail that must be addressed. So just before our talk and discussion about the water element, if you might remember, was this horrific mass killing in this club in Orlando. And so we really need to take some time and reflect together on how does the Dharma help us hold an event like that, and process it, and call on us to use our awareness of the Dharma to try to help heal beyond an event as tragic as that. And so, lo and behold, we had the same kind of thing happen this last week, didn't we? You know, we had two African-American civilians killed by white police officers in two different parts of the country, followed by a sniper attack on police officers in Dallas by a deranged African-American army veteran, right? So once again, we have beheld, we absorbed, we are searching for ways to be with yet another tragedy in American society, another violent tragedy. So I've been reflecting for the last few days on, okay, well, and when we last got together, we actually did find a way to see some connections between those two and how to hold them. So I want to do the same thing this evening, addressing first what the Buddha had to teach about the holding of, the processing of, the contributions we can make to the healing of our society from the kind of event that we've all just suffered. And then point out the relationship between the Buddha's teachings on that and his teachings on having to do with our relationship with the earth. Among the more well-known sets of teachings that the Buddha offered on the managing of, the understanding of, and the resolution of conflict had to do with a visit that he made to one of the religious communities that had been established to perpetuate his teachings. You know, he started off in his mid-30s teaching very small groups of people, and they just kind of wander around in the bush together up in northeastern India. And then gradually, as more and more followers began to go with him, it became a little unwieldy for these mass movements of, you know, 1,000 or 2 people wandering across the countryside. And so instead, what began to happen were the establishment of sort of teaching centers and practice centers, monasteries, where the monastics, the renunciates, would live for at least several months of the year at a time. Okay. And they would depend on the alms, the support from the surrounding community. And there was a certain amount of pressure put on the Buddha at this time. He said, well, look, we've got these other, you know, budding religious traditions here in the countryside, and they've all bought real estate, and they're making wine, or they're, you know, you know, figuring out other ways to make a buck out of here, you know, and they're kind of hustling the teachings a little bit, and they're getting pretty rich. We're still wandering around rags begging, you know, and it's some of what's wrong with this picture. The Buddha's response to that was this. He said, the reason that, at least as long as I'm alive, we are going to be mendicant monastics, you know, that we're not going to charge fees for our teachings. Okay. The reason that we're not going to adorn ourselves in fine silks and whatnot, you know, the style of the robes they had and the colors they wore, the way they came by them was people would throw away their clothing or they donate their clothing. They get recycled clothing and they would cut it up and they'd stitch it back together in robes. And then they would dye these robes that they made out of cast off clothing from the clays that were available on the riverbanks, you know, which turned out to be the ochre and the saffron color and whatnot. So that's where, and that's why all the monastics just, you still see wearing these robes and you still see them carrying their alms bowls, you know, because the Buddha did not want there to be established just another wealthy religious institution that in a very short period of time would become quite divorced from the needs of the people. He said the way that we'll know whether the Dharma is alive and whether the Dharma is useful and whether the Dharma is indeed achieving its objective is if the people find the teachings of the Dharma and those of us who seek to embody it sufficiently enriching in their own lives to support it with generosity. And so as these little regional practice communities were getting established and were getting bigger and whatnot, some of them, depending on who the leaders were that the Buddha had put in place, seemed to be doing a better job than others of really getting it as far as what the core teachings of the Buddha and how to practice them and how to live by and how to put them into practice in daily life, and also teaching the Dharma to the members of the community who were supporting him. In this one community in particular, the community of Kosambi, there arose a great division within the Sangha between these two rather proud teachers, one who was an expert in the discourses, the actual words of the Buddha, and the other who was the expert in how to put them into practice, the teachings into practice. And within this Sangha, there grew up these two camps of monks who were fiercely devoted to either one leader or the other, and they got into the business of saying unpleasant and unkind things about the other side and its leader and whatnot. And the situation got so bad that some of the monks in the Sangha said, you know, this isn't working at all. And they kind of ran off and found the Buddha and they said, we're in a world of hurt over here. Could you please come and help us sort it out? And so he went and he sat with them and he listened to both sides. And he said, do you remember that talk I gave about the, you know, causes of suffering, you know, first and second noble truths, and that the cause of suffering is craving and clinging. And he said, among all the things in one's lifetime or in one's consciousness that are particularly difficult to let go of are the idea, or the gratification of sense pleasures. The renunciation is really hard to pull off. Belief that rites and rituals are the way to liberation, not the case. Belief in a permanent and abiding self, from the soul or Atman, and attachment to views and opinions. Yes. And he said, this is exactly the kind of suffering that's going on in this Sangha right now. You have this, you know, powerful attachment to views and opinions, which is the actual antithesis of what I've taught all these years. And so he said, you know, you really need to do what you can to reflect on those teachings together and see if you can figure out a way to live in harmony once again. And he left. And within a day or so, they were at it again. And so the monks came back and got him again. He brought him back. He tried one more time. And then yet a third time. And when he came back the third time, he said, you know, remember our vows, remember our refuges. Taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in your own Buddha nature. Taking refuge in the Dhamma, taking refuge in the teachings on the way to freedom and enlightenment. And a refuge in the Sangha. And what he told them was, this Sangha has become so detached from the ability to take refuge in the Dharma because you are too proud and too attached to your views and opinions to surrender to those teachings, to allow the Dhamma to be a source of refuge. Because in order for it to be a source of refuge, you have to take in and embody its teachings. And you have lost the ability to become free of attachment to views and opinions. And he said, because of the fact you've lost that ability, the Sangha itself has ceased to be a place of refuge. You don't have three refuges anymore. The very sense of safety and sanctuary that is intended to be created by such a spiritual community has been lost. And if you don't regain it, this Sangha will collapse. And they failed to regain it, and the Sangha collapsed because the surrounding community said, these people are not walking their talk. They don't have a clue how to live the Buddha's teachings, and they are no longer worthy of support. And it dispelled. Okay. And so some of them wandered off and decided to take up Sufi dancing, and some of the others most of them came back they rejoined a different sangha that kind of had a better handle on, you know, how to do things. So those teachings, you know, sometimes, you know, I reflect on that a lot, you know, it's because conflict management is one of the things I taught when I was being a professor. But those teachings, I think, are very much as applicable to us, not only as we operate as a Sangha, and as other Buddha Dharma Sanghas operate, but I think it can be really rich and fruitful to think of our entire society as a Sangha. And that we either survive and thrive by taking care of each other in a way that the Buddha instructed Sangha members to do, or we collapse. We partially collapse. We live in a state of perpetual strife and discord. Okay. So, and it's not just Buddhists. You know, last week, my wife and I were invited to Iftar, which is a feast that Muslims partake of after sundown each evening in the holy month of Ramadan. And so when we were there, you know, enjoying the meal, I'd done some background study and talked to some Muslim friends beforehand about sort of core teachings of Islam and the significance of the ceremony, you know, these pillars of Islam, like faith and prayer and generosity, and the importance of fasting as a way, among other things, to get in touch with what it feels like to be really hungry and not be able to eat anything. Mm-hmm. To be in touch with those who are hungry, not because they chose to be, but because they have no food. Don Caldera, you know, Archbishop of, I think it was one of the cities in Brazil, said, when I ask for food for the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. So It's a way to be in touch with those who are less fortunate and to understand the need to help them. It's related to the teaching on generosity. And so, as I learned more about their teachings, the more I realized how much that faith tradition actually has in common with Christianity, how much it actually has in common with Judaism, how much it actually has in common with Buddha Dharma. You know, so we have faith communities from different denominations throughout our country, all of which share these same teachings on the need to figure out how to live together in mutually respective and even loving communities. Okay. And so I think it really calls on us to look for every opportunity we can find to be with others and witness that teaching, you know, basically to witness our own faith, not in the sense of proselytizing, but in the sense of joining with others and affirming the importance of living together in a certain kind of way in order to keep these tragedies from happening over and over again. So this core teaching of the Buddha with regard to Sangha, he said, in order for there to be genuine Sangha, in order for there to be a Sangha in which you can actually take refuge, you really need to learn how to live together in a mutually respectful, a mutual, and a community, an environment of mutual caring, of taking care of each other. Okay. Otherwise, you will not have the safety that you seek. He also taught this, not, you know, just to lay people or in discourses and whatnot. If you ever get, you know, decide you want to really study the texts of the Theravada Buddhist tradition, you'll find that going back to the time of the Buddha, the first language in which the oral teachings of the historical Buddha were basically put down on paper, reduced to writing, was in the Pali language, and they wrote his discourses on ola leaves with dye, and they bound the leaves together, like pages in the book, and he carried these piles of leaves around in these three different baskets, the Tipitaka. Okay. First basket was the discourses, okay, the transcribed teachings of the historical Buddha. Second one was a reorganization of the discourses in the framework of essentially a manual of Theravada Buddhist psychology called the Abhidhamma. And then the third basket was code of conduct, okay, called a Vinaya. And the way the Vinaya came into being was as the Buddha and his followers were kind of wandering around India and setting up camp and trying to figure out, you know, how to live together well and in keeping with his own teachings, you know. Things were not always, they were not always happy campers in Mr. Buddha's neighborhood. Every once in a while, things would get kind of rough-edged. And so two or more people would get into it over something or other, and they'd come to the Buddha and they'd say, well, we have this dispute between us about how to apply your teachings in a particular kind of way. And he would listen to both sides, and then he would offer a teaching on how they should resolve that particular issue. Basically put out a kind of a tenet of behavior or something for them to go by. And it occurred to people, you know, we probably ought to be writing this stuff down. And so they started doing that. And so the Vinaya is actually almost like a collection of case law of these different disputes that would be brought to the Buddha, and he'd resolve them and somebody would write it down. And so eventually it became this code of conduct. And for monastics, for people in robes, renunciates, who've devoted their lives to it, there, whether you're man or woman, there are about 225 to 235 different rules you have to live by. Not so easy to do. And the reason that they compile this code and keep it is because it is literally rules to live by. is how to live together in a peaceful community. In Asia, in the monastic communities to this day, there is this ritual of reconciliation or ritual of atonement that's practiced. And usually on the full moon night, once a month, once a lunar month, whenever there has been conflict between any two people in the Sangha, okay, the practice is to come together and for one to say to the other, if there is any way I've offended you, either knowingly or unknowingly, through anything that I've thought or said or done, I ask forgiveness. And then it either is or is not in the heart of the other to forgive. And because it usually takes two to tango, if the other person realizes they too were a party to the conflict and bear some responsibility for it, then they say, and if there's any way that I have harmed you, either knowingly or unknowingly, through anything I have thought, said, or done, I ask your forgiveness. And then if they can do that, they do it. And it's the way they peaceably reconcile differences within the Sangha. So real, tuned in a really minute and precise way to the nature of community and what's necessary in order to keep it healthy. Okay. So in addition to these rules for interpersonal conduct, okay, in the Vinaya, there are actually also quite a few rules having to do with how to live together in community on the physical plane. Stuff like how to dig an outhouse and keep it clean, you know, where to draw your water from, where to get rid of your waste, how to use the toilet, you know, how to practice personal hygiene, okay, how to conduct yourself with integrity, okay, but also in a way that's respectful of the impact that your presence there has on the environment. Not just your relations with other people, but the environment itself. It is very focused because of their regard for the sanctity of all life, you know, the need to protect all sentient beings. They're very tuned in to trying to minimize the environmental impact of their communities, okay, to waste just as little as possible, okay, and to have as little negative impact as possible on the environment, including things like, you know, the quality of the air and the water, you know, and the circumstances where they were living. So in that same regard, the Buddha taught, not only there, but in many other discourses, about relationship to oneself. Okay. And in the exposition on the elements, that's one of the things he does here. He said to, you know, it was kind of question and answer discourse that he was putting forth, and it was following along the theme of doing four elements practices as a way of kind of waking up from the trance of self, okay, by focusing on the air element, okay. And he talks about focusing on each of these elements. It has, he says, its inner aspect and its outer aspect. So you can focus on the air element internally. When you inhale, you take in air. You know, exhale, you put that air or some, you know, modified version of it back into the environment again. He said, is it your air? When you breathe it in? No. Is it your air when you breathe it out? No. It is the air element moving through you and all other sentient beings. Okay. There's the water element experienced externally, rivers and streams and rain and snow and whatnot. There's the water element experienced internally. You know, when we drink some beverage, okay, and the body converts it into the various fluids, you know, blood and the other fluids that we need to survive, okay. we hang on to all the water we've ever drunk? No, it wouldn't be a good idea even if it could, right? And we all look like water birds. But all that's happening is that the water element is moving through us, right? It's not our water. It's us participating in the hydrologic cycle. Okay. So I said, this is not me, this is not mine, this water element. This fathom-long body is indistinguishable from the environment of which it is a part. The fire element, right? You know, we do manipulate the environment and whatnot in ways to try to keep our body temperature within, you know, a livable range. But the body itself, of course, has all these mechanisms to try to do the same thing. When we get too cold, we shiver as a way of trying to warm the body up. When we get too hot, we sweat as a way of trying to cool the body off. It's a really good thing that those are not dependent on cognitive processes, isn't it? Oh, I think I'll shiver now, or oh, I think I'll sweat now. The body takes care of itself without us having to think about it. It's been doing it now for our particular species for well over 200,000 years, right? And so these are things that are happening irrespective of whether we do or do not want to have. They're simply natural processes that are going on. We, you know, give some thought to what we may want to eat, you know, what its effect on us may be and whatnot. But unless we want to kill ourselves off, what the Buddha came pretty close to doing before he reached enlightenment, just by starving ourselves, right? Then there are certain kinds of needs that the body has. Okay. So the Buddha says, think about the circularity of these elements, the air and the water, the energy, you know, the fire. He said, when you were first born, did you say to yourself, oh, I think I'll start beating this heart now? No. It started happening when you had a teeny little egg that you could hardly be seen in your mom's body, right? And from that time of inception until the end of your life, that heart's going to beat a certain number of times. And you don't sit around thinking, I think I'll beat the heart now, right? It's taking care of itself. It's the fire element at work. Okay. And it's working through us and flowing through us just like it is throughout the rest of the universe. So the Buddha said, you will live a happier and more relaxed life if instead of thinking about this being me and me controlling it, if you simply think of yourself as part of, as not separate from all these other processes that are going on. Said, but this collection of processes is also a sentient being. And since, you know, having taken the Bodhisattva vow for, you know, the liberation of the compassionate care for all sentient beings, that includes you. So even at the same time, we don't want to get too precious about my air or my water or, you know, my spleen or my kidneys, but just that this is stuff that's going on in the world right now. We nonetheless have this responsibility for the kind care of this fathom long body for as long as it's around, for as long as these compounded elements, okay, together. And, of course, the Buddha says, because of this circular, continuous relationship between us and the external elements, right? The care that we seek to devote to ourselves and to others, other humans, other sentient beings, is inextricably intertwined with the quality of the environment itself. If we poison the air, we poison ourselves. If we poison the water, we poison ourselves. If we become extravagant and unlimited in the way we generate heat on this earth, we destroy ourselves. if we do things that fundamentally alters the Earth's life carrying capacity, we harm ourselves and we harm all sentient beings. So in this understanding, to be a fully caring, compassionate human being, insofar as our care of ourselves, other sentient beings, it inevitably involves kind care for the Earth itself. And whenever we find or see things that are going on that are inhibiting or destroying the life-caring capacity of the Earth, then we're called upon as bodhisattvas to do something to restore that sense of care to what it once was. Okay. And that can have sort of real implications, you know, 200 years or so ago when we were in the process of getting climate change underway, you know, and we allowed pretty much anyone to do pretty much anything with the air and the water during the course of industrialization. We started poisoning ourselves like crazy, you know, and we're killing people off by the hundreds because of the stuff we're putting in the water and the stuff we're putting in the air. Gradually, as this nation became more technologically advanced and richer and whatnot, we decided there were certain kinds of behaviors that we didn't think were really acceptable anymore as far as industrial processes and whatnot. So we began to regulate them more and more stringently. And then major industries were starting to really sort of feel the pinch and say, well, if that's how you feel about it, we'll take our dollies and go home and go find somewhere else to do this instead. And so one of the things that's going on right now and has been in a major way for at least since the Clean Air and Clean Water Act came into being, first we had major polluting industries moving around the country, kind of like whack-a-mole. They'd find some state that had really weak laws and they'd set up shop there. And then finally we got national laws in the 1970s that said no matter where you are in the United States, you can't, there's certain things you can't put in the air anymore and certain things you can't put in the water anymore, at least not in high concentrations. And so just like they used to run around looking for states in the U.S. that had weak environmental laws, now they're doing the same thing globally. Okay. So one of the, and that's bringing into play, of course, the discussions we're having right now about global trade partnerships, right? Because what we have is a fair amount of evidence that in the past, when we've had these agreements come into being, all the, you know, the major multinational corporations that are looking around for, just like they did here in the old days, for the nations that have the weakest environmental laws, you don't have them on the books at all, or if they do have them in order to, you know, get money from the IMF and whatnot, they just never enforce them. And so that's where they're relocating, you know, and it winds up making for some strange situations every now and then. One of the world's leading producers of uranium in the world now for nuclear power plant fuel and also for nuclear weapons is Namibia. And they are cranking out the uranium in, you know, vast quantities, and they're doing really, really raunchy things to the environment that are going to poison it for thousands of years to come. So that's the number one source of income for Namibia. Number two source of income, tourism. So, what makes this awkward is that they allow uranium mining in the national parks. So, if you're going to travel in Namibia, they have some, you know, astonishing national park lands there. They're just something to behold. Better read your guidebook with some care, because there's some of those you may not want to visit when the wind's blowing the wrong direction, you know, or you happen to be downstream of the mining activity. So what's that got to do with us? Is there anything we can do? But you bet there is, you know. Based on what we choose to consume, what we choose to buy, where its ingredients come from, okay, we all bear to some extent some degree of karmic responsibility for that which we purchase. The rare earth elements that go into electronics, for instance, including electric cars, right? Unless you want to get really depressed and start feeling guilty, don't read about where the rare earth elements come from and how they're mined and what happens to the people who do them and what happens to the environment when they do it, okay? That's not a pretty picture, right? Which is not to say it can't be made safer, can't be made cleaner, okay? Can't be made safer for the workers, you know? If there is enough concern and consideration and attention devoted to it by those of us who are experiencing the fruits of all those labors. So it's like this vast, intricate web, you know, and it's not just overseas. There are places here in the United States where we have populations, usually impoverished ones, other, oftentimes ethnic minority populations, by virtue of where they live or what they do for a living, whose lives are being pretty seriously affected by the way we produce products and consume them and deal with the waste. Okay. So, you know, when I first began to teach and I would start to raise issues like that, I had people say, well, I came here to hear the Dharma, you know? I'm not coming back again until you stop getting off into these. Like you think, well, you know, that if we go back to what the Buddha actually had to teach in terms of the Vinaya and how they were to live on the land, this is the Dharma, you know? And I don't want to sit up here and abuse my position by telling you what to buy or not to buy, who to vote for, who not to vote for. What I do invite you to do is to consider the karma consequences of all the actions that we take, you know, relative to each other, relative to the environment, because they really make a difference. You know? And it all falls under this realm of sort of mutual care. You know? Caring for the earth is caring for each other. Because if the Buddha taught anything in the four elements, in the exposition on the elements practice, is that they are not distinguishable. We are not different from that which we breathe. We are not different from that which we imbibe, from that which we eat. You know? We are what we eat and what we drink and what we breathe. Right? We're not separate. Okay. Climbing down off my soapbox, let's have some reflections, some discussions, some questions that anyone might regarding what I have said.
I was listening to an interview on NPR with a guy who's a former cop and now working with these issues of police overreaction and so on. And it was interesting to hear what he had to say, because he said that that a certain tunnel vision exists in a cop who feels that he's threatened. You know, if he thinks that the guy he's got on the ground has a gun, even if the gun is in his pocket, he's not thinking rationally. There's this kind of, all that kicks in is this overwhelming fear and this need to protect himself. Yeah. So I'm wondering why the police departments of this country are not having mindfulness classes as the military has done and so on. Why not? I mean, you know, my experience in teaching inmates was that the one real benefit they got from it was the ability to stand back from the situation and not to just explode.
Yes.
You know, the capacity just to step back.
Yes. There is a time in our history when we called them peace officers. Yeah. So how do we get from peace officer to law enforcement officer, right?
Or militarized police department.
Yes. When I was teaching, I actually taught a class. It was a core class for in our criminal justice program, and it was for police officers at the command level and investigators and whatnot. And they talked about how the police literature is full of the iconography, the mindset of the police officer as a warrior. Mm-hmm. Said, you're going into the field and it's a dangerous place. You never know, you know, where the next threat might arise from. So that mindset of going into a war zone every time they go on shift, you know, is so radically at odds with how we would like for the police to serve the community, and for that matter, most of the police I know, how they want to serve the community. The part of it is that the militarization of the municipal police departments has been going on basically since the 1960s, when there were, you know, we had riots and whatnot, and they've just been getting more and more heavily armed ever since. And then we have these programs where the military gives their surplus weaponry to police departments, and so they, you know, it looked like Soweto, you know, in Ferguson, Missouri, the way everyone was fitted out and driving around these armed vehicles and so on. The other thing that really disturbs me every bit as much, you know, I think we need to do everything possible as far as demilitarizing police and training, making sure they get trained away so that they don't see everybody on the street as a potential threat, especially someone who may not be the same color as they, is entertainment. You know? Among the most popular shows, you know, out there is a kind of the NCIS franchise, and so they have this narrative going that if you're part of a military criminal investigative service, the Constitution doesn't apply. So you can run around blowing people away with abandon, which they do. You know, I've actually looked at the body counts on some of these shows. If there was a law enforcement officer, like these people, who killed a couple of people a week, right? They wouldn't be on the job real long because they would be considered to be insane, right? But somehow or another, with these hyper-violent cops and robber shows that we've got, the public gets the expectation that peace officers, the law enforcement, are only doing their job if they're killing people, right? They're protecting you if they kill somebody else, right? Instant justice. And as long as there is an appetite for that, as long as we ingest that kind of thing mentally, as long as we're not to the point where we're going to call that out and say, you know what, you're presenting a radically distorted and diseased picture of American society, and you're causing people to think our world is a much more violent place than it actually is. And until we can just turn away from that narrative and say, you know, this is harming us in a really positive way, I think it's going to be problematic. You know? I see that as, personally, I see that as mental and emotional pollution of our society, every bit as much as water air pollution is. Yeah, please.
Well, that makes me think that the answer to that could be, well, that's what people want to see. That's what, you know, they want to see on TV. And then we come back to what I think is deep down inside of us, we all have probably a violent side or something inside of us that is angry or not peaceful or at war with something internally. And so the importance of then making peace within to be able to then be peaceful.
I think one of the narratives, both in the news and also certainly in a lot of, you know, drama, law enforcement drama, entertainment, the bedrock, the thing that fuels it, that feeds it all is fear. Okay. And so you begin with, you lay the foundation with a narrative of fear. And if you're in a perpetual state of fear, then you're looking around for some strong force to serve you, to keep you from being harmed by that which you're afraid of. And so, I mean, and that narrative, I think, really needs to be seen as in parallel with narratives of hope and of kindness. And looking at how one tends to crowd out the other, and in my view, becoming somewhat more engaged in public dialogue when we can, to say, you know, when we're afraid, it does not bring out the best in us, mm-hmm. and it doesn't bring out the best in our leaders, and it doesn't usually result in very good public policy. You know? And it's probably not the path we want to go down. We want to live in a safer, happier society in the future.
You know, the president talks about that. He'll say that. He says things about We need to choose hope over fear. We need to use kindness over whatever. He gets criticized for being weak, which is interesting.
And he, as well as a lot of law enforcement officers that I know, as well as other political leaders, say, you know, to the extent that we demonize American Muslims, that is a direct threat to our national security, because it causes them to not feel welcome, to not feel as if they want to come forward and share information about potential wrongdoing when it arises. If they feel like they themselves are under the gun, that they themselves are in battle minority, it doesn't foster the kind of support and loyalty for the country that we need to have if we're gonna move forward together.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Please.
First of all, I think the exploitation and violence towards the earth, it's all rooted in the same thing, the violence towards each other, the exploitation of other people and areas. But you said something about turning away, and I think that's important, because I think I was having a conversation about the two black men who had been shot at work, and one of the things that I said, and I had to catch myself later, was, you know, I don't recognize where I live anymore, because it's become so divisive, it's so violent, and so over the top. But what I was actually thinking after that is, I mean, that's my privilege speaking too. It's up now where it's obvious to most all of us that it's like that. But like just wiping it back isn't going to make it better, because there are people in the community and African Americans and Hispanics and people that with less money, and I mean a thousand different groups, who have never had that sense of peace, or that had a sense that the officers were safe to call. And I think there really is a need to turn away and create something that is different, and not just think that we can kind of go back to the good old days or something.
Place of refuge. Also, when we flip the switch, we want the light to come on. When it's 100 degrees outside, we want it to be 70 degrees in here. You know, there is a pretty direct connection between our desires in that regard and what happens to the earth as well. And so kind of walking that back, right, involves kind of reconnecting on a level in a way that shows us, you know, yeah, we really do need an effective energy grid, and we really do need ways to generate electricity that serve us and yet at the same time don't destroy the life carrying capacity of the earth at the same time. So it's not like all industry is bad or whatnot, because a lot of that is out there that's crucial to our survival, you know, transportation infrastructure, utility infrastructure, all these other things are what keeps us going as a society. So it's not that they're evil, it's that we simply need to be continuing to work on more mutually caring means of achieving those objectives, whether it's socially or environmentally. And I promise if you leave aside a little time so you all could peruse the books. So why don't we now settle back into our sitting posture for just a moment. Allowing the eyes to once again close, intention to come to rest on the pianos. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be free of physical affliction and mental anguish. May we acknowledge and accept any suffering we find within us or see in each other with courage and with caring and with kindness. May our friends and families and loved ones, all those whom we hold dear, all those in our communities, those whom we know and do not know, like and do not like, may they likewise live with ease, safe from harm. May they be happy. May they be peaceful. May they be free. All those who suffer violence and all those who are perpetrated, may we be happy and peaceful and free. All beings who walk the earth and live within it, all beings who fly in the skies above, swim in the waters below, all beings both seen and unseen, all beings in all the realms of existence, may all beings live with ease. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free. Have a safe journey home.